This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
It's really lovely to see so many bright-eyed faces. My name is Nenzen, and this is my friend, brother, son, co-teacher, Ocean Sensei. We are the teachers of Jikoji Zen Center, and I'm so happy Ocean is here all the way from Baltimore now to sit with us for this next week of Sesshin, which is a week-long retreat. So welcome back.
Good to be home.
Tomorrow, as I mentioned, we begin a Sesshin here. It's one of the four annual Sesshins that our founder, Koban Chino Otogawa Roshi, set up for us to do every year. The word Sesshin, I mentioned, it means an extended period of meditation practice. It comes from two words, setsu, which means to touch or to gather, and shin, heart-mind. So to gather the mind, to touch the heart-mind. And it is a place where you sit down, and as you practice this morning, and face that wall for a week, and you do touch your heart and mind. You gather yourself together. You gather the whole world together, just you and the wall and everyone else sitting with you. It's very profound often to sit down quietly for a long period of time and watch what happens. So I encourage you. I know it sounds scary, but I encourage any of you who have the time and hear the temple bell to come give it a try. This particular sesshin that starts tomorrow is called Denkoe. Denkoe means, literally translates as the transmission of light, and it is also the name of this book, Transmission of Light. And this book is called Denkoroku, Transmission of Light in Japanese. This book chronicles the enlightenment stories of all of the ancestors from Buddha all the way down to Eno, Master Eno, which is about 1240 in Japan. So because Kobun chose the transmission of light, this record and that experience of love, warm hand to warm hand, from heart to heart, like a little flickering of the candle, passing, 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 all the way from Shakyamuni to us, to you. I thought it would be good to talk a little bit about this idea of light in our practice of Zen. And I'm going to start with asking you to sing a song. And you may or may not know this song. Some of you know this song. Chak-san, can you please take one and pass it along or pass them out? This song is called This Little Light of Mine. And we're going to sing it together. I hope Ocean Sensei will sign it as well as he can.
Thank you.
I should have kept one of them. Could I have yours, Chuck?
Sure.
I think I know the words, but I might hope for you to see them as we go. So just be a child and sing, okay? Nobody's going to judge you or evaluate you. Just let's try to sing like one voice singing together, okay? Just be playful. And see if everybody has one. You know, please share. Make a friend. Okay, ready? Ish? Okay, help me, folks. One, two, three. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. My brothers and my sisters, I'm gonna let them shine, my brothers and my sisters. I'm gonna let them shine, my brothers and my sisters. I'm gonna let them shine, let them shine, let them shine, let them shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. All around the world, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Thanks, Tess. So, you might think that this is like just a childhood song, but this little light, I think, points to something important and deeper, and pointing to this kind of luminous awareness, luminous meaning clarity, an awareness of the mind that is always present and always shining, even when we forget and fail to notice it. In the Zen lineage, this little light is not something we're creating. It is denkoi. It is the transmission of light. All the way from Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening to now, right here, now. All the way from Bodhidharma's crossing the Yangtze in China to Hogen to Dogen to Weining, before that, receiving the robe and the bowl. These are all stories of the recognition of the light that is always here. And our role as teachers is to help you remember it and return to it. It's always already here for you to see and experience, given, and nor can it be taken away. It's just present. So when the song says, I'm going to let it shine, that I'm going to let this little light in me shine, try not to think of it as I'm going to let my ego shine. Not like, I'm going to shine. Not like that so much. More like, I'm going to shine my light on you and you on me and in connection. To let it shine, to let it shine you, to make that light come out of you, it's already here, is like dropping any kind of separation or obstruction between this, and you, and the whole world. Let it shine. So the question really becomes, how do we let it shine in our daily lives, where we feel obstructed and burdened often? And how do we let it shine in the face of our fears, in the face of our stresses? How do we not let it shine? How do we put out the light with our anxiety and fear? So just as the light of transmission passes from teacher to student, in each moment of our shared existence, there's light passing between us. And you know this sometimes. You experience it. You see it right in front of you, and you enjoy it. This light passes naturally everywhere. You don't have to do anything about it except notice. So we practice a lot of zazen, noticing. Many years ago, once before Denkoi Sishin here a few years ago, someone who came for the first time, which is a very brave and courageous thing to do, asked me right before Denkoi started, what if I do it wrong? What if I can't sit still? Or my mind will not stop? What happens if I can't stand my legs falling asleep or an itch? It's a lot of anxiety. And I tried to reassure her by saying, don't worry. Everyone here is doing it wrong in his or her or their own special way. So we had a little laugh, and I saw the relief in her eyes, which is kind of light. Fear loosening its grip is light. And so for the rest of the week, every time we noticed each other, or I noticed something going a little bit off course maybe, I thought, here we go again, doing it all wrong together. That's a little light you're noticing when that happens. So I mentioned this book, the Denko Roku, is filled with transmission stories. The person in the story is his teacher and a student, and they're all the stories, they're all of our ancestors and our lineage. And they're awakening stories, meaning moments where a teacher in relationship with a student and the student wakes up. Okay, enlightenment sounds like a big fancy word, and when we hear about enlightenment stories, we tend to project, you know, bolt of lightning strikes you and you're free of all suffering for the rest of time, and something very otherworldly and lofty. But what's evident when you read the Denko Roku is these people are just like us. They are us, and we are them. They suffer from doubt and fear and confusion. They're meeting their own suffering just like we meet our suffering. They recognize that through the very conditions of their suffering, they awake in the middle of this ordinary life. They wake up. I personally find it a great comfort to think that it is our ordinary life, full of stress, that is complicated and messy, usually, as de rigueur, it's pretty messy. And that complicated, ordinary, messy, beautiful life is the condition of being awake. It is where we wake up. There's no place else, not even a Zen center, where you go and put in your ticket and wake up. It's in your life all the time, like the light. Difficulties and the beauty, not separated, is where we wake up. That's where the light gets transmitted. It's always here. And I think you know that it's always here, because you drove up the mountain this morning. You're exhibit A, proof of the light. Because you drove up that mountain this morning, because you know that there's this very deep, intentional awareness in you, and you want to make it fit your life, and you want life to fit that awareness. You want there to be some kind of mutuality of agreement, of intention and purpose and fulfillment with that deep knowing, which is that light. This flame that recognizes our interconnection. It just does not separate us from each other, no matter where we live, or who we look like, or anything else. So, believe it or not, I want to talk about stress today. After making you sing that lovely song, that was just to soften you up, so I could talk about stress. Because, you know, not seeing stress as darkness or something to escape from, but stress as the condition of your being able to sing that song about this little light of mine. And stress is absolutely inextricably part of our lives, right? If any of you this week checked your emails or watched the news or had a hard time getting a parking spot or whatever it is in your life that makes you go, or had difficulties with loved ones or said goodbye to someone who died or had to sit and hold the hand of someone who was sick, or just yourself felt such anguish and sadness about the state of the world or the state of your relationship, whatever. All of those things are good examples of stress. It's part of this beautiful life, stress. So I hope you survived it. You obviously did. You're here. It's just so deeply woven into our lives. And even when we want to relax, even when we intentionally want to relax, sometimes the body and the mind kind of don't get the memo. And it's hard. It's hard to let go. And I want to tell you that the Buddha in particular, but Buddhism in general, does not shy away from stress. It's a pretty valid and important place with which we practice because it's our life. It's part of everything. In fact, the Buddha's very first ennobling truth, the first noble truth is there is stress. It's called dukkha in Sanskrit. Could be translated as unease or dis-ease or discomfort or suffering. It's the very first thing he taught is, guess what, folks? It's a given. There's going to be some difficulty in life. There is stress. It exists. He did not pretend that life is easy. He did not. Nor can we. No matter how much you try, you can't pretend. So the Buddha taught another way of being with stress, and to allow it to be, I would call it a pointer. Stress is not a problem to eliminate or kill or get rid of, but rather a threshold, a doorway to your own awakening. So these are the Buddha's words. And this is from the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the Buddha speaking. And he says this: how, monks, does a monk dwell contemplating feelings and feelings? Here, when a pleasant feeling, a monk understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he, she, they understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Goes on, many other experiences. So the Buddha's talking about not denying those feelings, not pretending like they don't exist, but observing. When we feel stressed, what do we usually experience in our bodies? Well, I know I can very often go into, you know, what our body would tell us is flight. Fleeing, running away, let's get away from this problem. Freeze, being paralyzed. Fawning, that's a new one, fawning. Okay, let me do whatever you want me to do. Make it go away, make it go away, make it go away. So flee, flight, freeze, or fawn. Flee, flight, they're the same thing. So flight, freeze, or fawn. Did I leave one out?
Fight.
Yeah, of course I did. I don't really like to fight. Fight, yeah, come on, bring it on. I'll take you down. These are our responses, and they're very instantaneous, and you really experience them in the body. I think if you were going to put the language to that feeling of stress, that overwhelming, you would say, this shouldn't be happening, I don't like it, something is really wrong. That's underneath all of those responses. I don't like it, it shouldn't happen, it's really wrong, right? Well, the Buddha doesn't say anything like that. He says, he recommends that we notice, that we just pay attention, and then pay attention to our responses. I think he's saying, borderline, welcome it. Welcome stress. Now, I'm not saying he's saying, go out and look for it. He's not saying, let's go run up some, you know, find some difficulties in life. They will present themselves very naturally. But he's saying, welcome them. And I think he's saying, welcome them so that you can figure out what's really happening. In my experience, when I notice a lot of feelings coming up, stress, I know there's a misalignment, like this, in me. It's not about what's happening out there. It's here. Unfortunately, it's always here. If you could fix my problems, I'm sure you would. And if I could fix yours, I would. But it's up to us. So this misalignment is kind of between what my intentions are, how I want to be in the world, how I want to live, how I want to present, how I want to receive, and what's happening. I think there's a disconnect. It's this misalignment. Somehow I'm not able to bring this into mutuality. And sometimes reality doesn't seem to be offering it. But reality is through these eyes. So the Buddha is saying, it's through your own experience. You notice it, and then what? And the other thing for me is that this pointer of stress that I experience in body and mind often comes because I'm overwhelmed and I've bitten off more than I can chew. So in my experience, and I bet in yours too, this pointer of stress, however it enters your life, is signaling something very important, signaling that something very deeply important to me doesn't feel aligned with how my experience is. I care very deeply. I'm invested very deeply, and something in that care has made me feel very vulnerable. So in this practice, which you practiced this morning with us, facing the wall, we notice, just as the Buddha said, we notice. And we can notice practicing with stress not like a dark hole, but as a chance to wake up to what's happening right now and to understand what we value, what we actually love, what we really, really care about. So I'm asking you to imagine for the rest of your lives that stress is not an enemy. It's more like a bell, like the bell that Giroux is ringing this morning. Imagine when the stress bell rings, it's you saying, wake up, wake up. We don't try to kill the bell. That wouldn't solve the problem. Instead, we walk towards the bell. We notice. We don't have to hug the bell. Except you, bell, or anything extra. You can just be with the bell and watch what's happening in your body and then what's next after you've noticed this experience. One of my first teachers told me a story about a student who came up to him exasperated about the experience of sitting and said, whenever I sit, my legs hurt, my back hurts, my body is complaining, it's stressed out and complaining. And then I go home and my partner is stressed out and complaining. Then I go to work and my boss is stressed out and complaining. Everywhere I go, stress follows me everywhere. And the teacher said, yeah, stress is really faithful, like a really loyal dog. So wherever you go, it's going to follow you. So why do you keep kicking the dog? Why do you keep kicking the dog? Try petting it and see what happens. I know. You want to say something?
Mm-hmm. So there's this koan. You asked me to think about, find a koan that might fit this, a traditional Zen teaching story that might have some of these qualities. And I thought about this one. Joshu earnestly asked Nansen, what is the way? And Nansen answered, ordinary mind is the way. And maybe he would say, stress, stress is the way. Joshua asked, should I direct myself toward it or not? And Nansen said, if you try to turn toward it, you'll go against it. Joshua asked, if I do not try to turn toward it, how can I know that it's the way? Nansen answered, the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blank consciousness. When you've really reached the true way, beyond all doubt, you will find that it's vast and as boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on a level of right and wrong? At these words, Joshua was suddenly enlightened.
Pretty radical, right? It's practicing with the stress puppy, basically. Right? Not kicking the stress puppy. Just being with the stress puppy. All the stress puppies. Anger, loss, fear, grief, all of it. Sadness. So, what do we do? What do we actually do with the stress puppy? Well, we don't kick it. And in my own practice, what I try to do is I have, I notice two responses. One, the first level of response is I've trained myself to do that. Breathe. Just breathe. It tends to interrupt the cycle of reactivity. Just the breath. Just the breath. We do this naturally, but just give yourself a breath. Feels good. Calms down the sense that I got to do something, I got to do it now. That fight, flee, freeze, or fawn. You don't have to. Second, what I typically like to do is say, I name it. Stress is here, anger is here, sadness is here, longing is here, grief is here. Not, I'm stressed, I'm freaked out, I'm angry. Not I, but it's here. The stress puppy has come to visit. And then for me, I try to find it in my body. This happens to be an embodied practice. So I always look for, where am I feeling this? So it's, I feel like the head is like this giant thing we're carrying around and having to support. But we can actually identify stress in our body. For me, it's very reliably in my neck, shoulders, sometimes in my tummy, in my stomach. And I just pay attention to the puppy there in a kind of loving, affectionate way. Like, doggy has found an expectation. Doggy has sniffed out a fear. Doggy has sniffed out a loss or a grief or a sadness. And in that moment, when I can say, doggy has found this experience, that is a moment of insight. Everything softens after that. It's just okay. And it requires for me, again, it might be different for you, all of those steps. Awareness of noticing, naming, where is it in my body, and then letting the dog run free. Not kicking it and getting rid of it and shoving it away, but letting go. I want you to notice that when I explained this process to you, I did not kill the puppy. I did not try to get rid of the puppy. I didn't lock up the puppy. I didn't leash the puppy. I was practicing with just being with the puppy in my ordinary, stressful, complicated, beautiful, messy life. Here's the puppy. This is ordinary stuff, and yet it rules us if we cannot be okay with it. So in the koan, the Ocean Sensei brought up, ordinary mind is the way. It's one of my favorites, because so often we want a special thing to happen to relieve us. I mean, I would say that 99% of the people who come to beginning meditation want me to remove their heads. They just would like me to just take it off, put it in a corner, and let them rest. That's kind of a special experience. We want something like that, or we want something very lofty, you know, a bolt of lightning. Definitely something special that will relieve our ordinary stress and our confusion. But Joshu says, nope. Ordinary mind is the way. Washing the dishes, cleaning the toilet. Did I just do washing right? I'm trying to learn a little bit as we go. Just everyday life, getting stuck in traffic is the way. Being in an argument with your loved one, that's the way. That's what's happening right now. It's your opportunity right now, right here. It's actually, these stresses are actually this great gift for you to inspect what your own experience is and then make some skillful choices. So traffic jams, parking problems, late doctors, getting up late, going to bed too late, whatever is happening in your life, the actual experience, unpleasant as you call it, is actually the way to awakening. Just like all of these people. They were just like us. So the moment we pretend that we have to escape whatever it is that's stressful, we have to flee, we've actually turned away. And Joshu says, don't turn away. Joshu is speaking to us from way back then in China, telling us, pay attention. Be with what's happening in your ordinary life. So the art of our practice is not pretending that stress isn't here, but refusing to make it worse when it is here. That's your job. Don't make it worse. That's my job too. Some years ago, I was standing in line at the airport. I'd gotten there an hour early for a domestic flight, plenty of time, right? And the security line, this is before I got clear, the security line was unbelievable. I mean, people were like going out the door. It was so bad. I don't know what's going on. The drug sniffing dogs or bomb sniffing dogs were out. And everyone in that line was so tense. They're looking at their watches. They're like, I'm not going to make it. Some people were being elitist and saying, I need special treatment, whatever. It was not a beautiful display of humanity. They were really stressed out. And like you, I'm a wave, like all this anger and stress, and this is not how it's supposed to go, and I don't like it, and it's not how I want to live my life, you know, all that noise, just like a loudspeaker drowning out the parking instructions. It was really loud for me. And then I noticed this little, maybe a 5 or 6 year old little girl in front of me, way in front of me, with her little pink suitcase and a teddy bear in her arm. She was thrilled. She is having no problem in this moment. She's getting ready for the next big adventure of her life. And she's like, teddy, look at the suitcase, look at the people. She was ecstatically happy with this moment. And I turned that, she really helped me, this little girl. I just said, oh, we could all be really happy in this moment with our little pink suitcases and our teddy bears. This is meeting stress, welcoming the puppy, seeing what's happening and saying, I don't actually have to suffer this. I don't have to make it worse for me, and I don't have to contribute to that wave of discomfort in the room. We are all in the line for security at the airport all the time. We're all in the same line, going through the same stress. So the stress puppies will arrive. In the email that you've been dreading writing or reading, in the phone call, in the disagreement with your loved ones, in the meeting that you don't want, in just trying to get through a long, hard day when things don't seem to be falling into place. And your opportunity is to remember that stress is not a detour. Stress is not a detour. It's the opportunity. It's ringing you down the path. It's the bell ringing you down to the path. It's getting very Pavlovian, isn't it? The bell and the dog, sorry. For those of you know about Pavlov, he did this experiment with ringing bells and making dogs salivate, sorry. But stress is the ringing of the bell that lets you identify your stress puppy and meet it and greet it and figuring out what is really important in this moment to you. What is it that doesn't feel okay? And then take care of it lovingly. So tomorrow we enter Denkoe Sesshin, almost a full week of sitting here in silence. We do eat and get up and walk and do kinin and work, but it's a time to really turn that light of awareness. Pay attention to this light of awareness, because this transmission of light is not something that happened once a long time ago with these ancient ancestors. It's happening right now, all the time, in this very moment. Even when you're noticing your stress, even noticing where it is in your body, even naming it. Our practice is not about waiting for a special circumstance, like the teacher said. No, it's nothing special. It's just now. Seeing the light of your own awareness, even in the midst of your confusion and unhappiness. Seeing that light. Even in difficulty, even in sadness, even in stress, in any of its forms. When you're willing to do this, and it is courageous, I'm going to tell you, it's courageous. When you're willing to do that, you can take the leash off your own neck, drop it, and be free. Because you know how to integrate your deepest vow to yourself, to life, with what's happening right in front of you. So when we take our seat tomorrow in Sesshin, it's not just us sitting down, it's all those guys and women, all those ancestors. This was written by the way, it's attributed, I shouldn't say written because there's lots of controversy about that, by Kaizen Zenji. And he was one of the two most important founders of Soto Zen, of which we are a part. So when we sit down tomorrow, we're taking Kaizen Jing. With us and the Buddha and Dogen and our founder Koban and all of our teachers, not just Zen teachers, but our teachers, the people in our lives, whether they are children with pink suitcases or each other. And we pass our light, light to light, candle to candle. Let's do that together. This is time for you. This whole thing is for you. So if you have any questions, and I'm sure one of your questions might be about, wait a minute, the world's on fire. How are we supposed to deal with this and not feel bad about it? You can feel bad about it. It's heartbreaking. And then what? What's next? Anybody? Russ.
So, well, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about is, say, some of the Buddhas, like there is suffering, and that's due to craving and pushing away. So, and what you're doing is describing kind of a way to work with that, and yet, like Joko talks about, after this talk, you're going to just sort of forget about it and not, you know, like, how, what prevents us from, like, seeing these very clear things about, and but not actually doing it, or like, what are the hindrances to this? Like,
you mean what is in the way of our actually acting on it?
Yeah, like, I mean, is it just more like diet and exercise that we just got to keep at it and put it on the refrigerator, or how do we actually implement this?
I was just reading this story where someone asked G.U. Kennett about awakening, and said, oh, I was reading about this Kenshaw, let's talk about this little awakening and big awakening, and I had this kind of question like this, I think. And G.U. somehow responded like, awakening is not something like we receive, it's something that like we express, that we are, you know. Can you run with that?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So if you know, let's see how to put this. You already know what you don't know. You already know what you don't know. It's already present. And what we do, and I know you do, in this practice is pay attention. You notice. You're very observant, actually. Mm. So paying deep attention, practicing paying deep attention, there isn't a separation. You're not going to forget about it. It's a way of being in life, not just being here. You're already awake. You're already awake to it. So you have to build the muscle, I suppose, kind of like you. I like this, going to the gym. But it's more like going to your seat, practicing being present in this life, and being aware of what's happening, what's actually happening. And then it's not like you have to decide what to do next. For me, in my life, what I notice is really difficult things always have the image of, oh, I have to clean the dishes. Now, it's not dishes that needed to be cleaned, but I have to meet what's actually right in front of me. You cannot go out and solve the problems of the world. There isn't problems. There isn't solving. But you can meet what's right in front of you with that deep awareness that it's right here already. Mm-hmm. It's really natural, actually. And it comes from sitting and developing this compassion for your own experience. And then, as I mentioned to some of the people in beginning instruction this morning, when you really start to care about yourself in a loving way, it's no different than caring about the next person, total strangers, and the whole world. You don't have to go do anything. You just have to be really, really truthful with yourself about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then the light just shines out.
Yeah, we just keep focusing on manifesting it and expressing it, and somehow the thing right in front of us will kind of take care of itself. It'll take care of us.
Yeah.
It'll take care of us.
From my experience, so actually when you're observing, when you're aware, you actually create a space between the environmental and your response. So actually, freedom and peaceful life in that space.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say that a little louder?
Sorry. So I'm saying, so when you're observing and you find this awareness, you actually create, cultivate a space between the environment and your response. Sometimes you have automatic response. You want to react. You want to solve the problem. And most of the time, the freedom and the peaceful lie in that space you just cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're describing very beautifully this thing that we often call the gap.
Oh, the gap.
Okay. Yeah, and we have a choice sometimes. What that gap is sometimes our suffering,
yeah.
You know, that distance between where I am and where I think I should be. We create a gap, and so What do we fill that in with? We fill that gap in with a lot of suffering. But there's opportunities to fill that in with a lot of light and awareness.
And love. You know? Love. I don't mean, you know, hearts and emojis. Love. I mean this deep appreciation of your life and life and the light from your eyes.
So what you're saying makes complete sense. It's absolutely essential. I agree. I understand. I've experienced how that changes my life for me. So it's essential, but is it sufficient?
Sufficient for what? What's the rest of that?
There are a lot of really terrible things happening in the world. And the sense of not doing things to repair can be overwhelming. I come from a Jewish tradition where there's the Tikkun Olam, which, it's not my responsibility to fix everything, but should fix something. How do you reconcile those two?
I like what Suzuki Roshi says. He said, shine one corner of the world. And sometimes I get really overwhelmed with, there's a lot of things in my life, And I try to make my life really simple sometimes. And it still can feel overwhelming. And I can remind myself, it's okay to just shine one corner of the world. I don't have to fix everything. And just attend to what I'm attending to, And, with this, protests and this is really great energy, and I love lending my energy to those things, and I'm also really aware I'm not letting some of the things that are going on in the world kind of change me. The world also needs these kind of peaceful warriors, just showing up with their whole heart and being tender and listening. And that's really brave and really hard to do that. So, thank God for this practice. There's a foundational support of wisdom teachings and ancestral teachings, and a group of people, a sangha, that are really focused on compassion and wisdom. That can support me to keep shining this one corner, just taking care of my little thing, because that's what the world needs. And the world needs you doing your thing really well, loving really fiercely.
Yeah, imagine if everyone in this room and everyone in this room to whom you're related did that. It'd be a better world. It would be a repaired world.
There
we go.
There you go.
I'm with Ocean Sensei. Take care of yourself and you can take care of the world. If you stop making war here, war's end. But everyone has to do that. And it's a big ask.
Yeah, it's a great koan where there's a Zen master in the field, taking care of the crops. And this monk comes up to him and it's like, how can you be out here in the field kind of like when the world is like that? And, how can you compare that, And he's like, what do you call the world? What do you call the world? I'm taking care of the world. I'm taking care of things. I'm here. But sometimes you get really into this concept of that. That can really pull us away from what we intended to do. And what I intended to do is help bring the world back into alignment with this kind of love, the first kind of loving awareness, and planting rice, growing rice is love too, So I need to remind myself of that, washing the dishes with love, protesting with love, all of it.
Does it mean like we know how to better handle the stress and then we will feel less stressful?
She asked, if we keep practicing, will we know better how to handle the stress? And stop feeling dreadful. I haven't heard that word in a long time. I like it, dreadful. It does feel dreadful some of the time, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to offer you a guarantee because I can't do that. It's up to you, like it was up to me and everyone else, but I'm a very strong flag waver for the practice. Because what we do when we're sitting down is stop evaluating great or dreadful. We eventually, there's especially during Sesshin, you get exhausted of those comparisons. When you sit for the first 3 days, that's all you're doing, a lot of noise. Like, and then there was this, and then they said that, and there's all sorts of stories. And eventually you get so sick of your stories. You're like, okay, I've heard it before. Okay, I get it. And it's no more dreadful. It's like you're emptied out of all that extra stuff, and you're just a little light shining on your little cushion with all the other little lights shining on your cushion. And that, for me, has been an extremely reliable experience. So I'm not going to tell you that there won't be suffering, because I told you the Buddha's first teaching, there is suffering. The world has always been on fire, he also says. And I don't think it's going to change. You know, I think there's always going to be this. I hope not. But what I can do is not insist that my happiness depends upon it being different. My fulfillment of my own experience of this shared life is not dependent upon it being a certain way, because expectations are the killer. So how about just meeting what's here, being with it, letting go of your story about how it shouldn't be like this, and then doing what you can to not make it worse. And sometimes that means making it better. You know, write your congressperson, go on a march. Not only does it maybe make it better in a bigger way, but it also makes you better, and it makes everyone you're around better. It's incredibly like, well, look, I'm not alone. All these other people really care deeply too. So, yes, less dreadful because you stop thinking of reality as dreadful. I'm not saying that you won't read the news and suffer. There is suffering. But you can reframe it as, that's what's here. How can I not make it worse? And not hurting yourself is...
So I guess, like, I mean, obviously it's super awesome to have, like, also, like, these meditation sessions, like, maybe, like, you know, once a day. But I feel like sometimes, like, let's say you're at work, right, and you have, like, a stressful situation, and maybe you, like, or maybe, like, if you're, like, or, you know, you go on, like, your favorite social media platform, and there's tons of, like, news or, you know, stuff like that that makes your mind even more, like, stressed. Like, I mean, maybe it might be a little bit too much of a personal question, but, like, what do you guys maybe, like, do, like, I mean, maybe you guys also use social media, but maybe you're mindful, but, like, what do you do in your daily, like, non-meditation time that allows you to sort of maybe be less stressed out, I guess?
I don't go on social media much, yeah.
I think that's a dangerous place to practice.
Yeah.
You know, meeting certain areas of my life with more intention is very helpful. So for me, like, to really kind of answer, you know, kind of the question of, like, engaging, like, social media, you know, things like the news or certain things, I set aside certain times, like, literally, this is my time to read this, and I only engage it in kind of certain ways and on certain platforms. I'm intentionally learning about the world. I want to know what's going on. I want to be curious. I want to care, and I want to listen to the world. And so that's the way I frame it, and I kind of do that. And I subscribe to a kind of a news digest kind of website, you know, and kind of brings it all together for me, and all the best editorials, you know, and all that stuff. And I take it in, and it's like, okay, and then I put it down. And I think the meeting it with intention is really, really important. You know, what am I doing? What am I going to do here? But I think also the putting it down is something that's really important that we need to look at. Like, how do I transition away from that? Yeah, we have to be aware of what's going on in our lives, in our world. And we can't turn our back on it, but we're not living in that stress that way.
We have someone in common whom we both love, who watches, he's 80 years old, and he watches cartoons, like kids' cartoons, when he needs to just, you know, be playful again, to remember to be, that life is delicious and fun. He turns on really ridiculous cartoons. Whatever. You know, you can remember there's joy. You can exercise your capacity to experience joy as well. Social media is generally not joyful, although I like the recipes.
Yeah, New York Times cooking.
That's it. That's a safe place.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if I'm there and I'm engaging it and I'm worrying and I'm complaining and it's this and this and this and then I turn up the way. And have I done anything? You know, have I done anything? Usually I'm just spending all this energy and I'm stressing and I'm getting myself upset and I don't do anything. But I know what works and I know what I like and I know what skills I have. So I know that one corner of the world that I can shine. I know where I can go and what I can do to make it better. So I stay with that. And that feels a lot better than doom scrolling. Yeah.
So may I share my little 2 cents? So recently I created a 95% rule for myself, meaning I think 95% of the information or possessions are all noises, like I can get rid of. I don't really need them. Only about 5%, that's what I truly need. Mm. And that's what I choose to take. So, for example, social media. So I deleted many apps. I just don't need to go there. I don't read news. I don't listen to news. My theory is if something important, it will come to me anyway from the limited sources that I choose to, I think most of the information there is noise, it's just noise. When you consciously just pick what is important to you, then your inputs get very selective and your life become much more simple and make you, so basically you don't waste your energy and time on something just noise and irrelevant. That's what I realized.
Thank you. There's one person doing it. You're a model for the rest of us. Yeah, you could say you are what you eat,
yeah.
Right? The old me used to say that, you are what you eat. And you
yeah,
are what
consuming,
you eat.
Yeah. More conscious consumption is okay.
Yeah.
You can bring a little more awareness into that. Yeah. Yeah. It's that koan where he's saying, you know, how can planting rice, you know, compare with all these affairs of the world? And he's like, what do you call the world? You know, it's just, to me, that's like social media. You know, I'm building things, I'm talking to friends, I'm helping people along, I'm baking bread, and feeding people, and trying to do these things, right? You know, and then somebody, oh, there's all these things that are on fire, and others, yeah, but what do you call the world? Like, right here, right now, what do we need to do? What do we need to do? What can we do right here, right now, with what we have? That's a lot less stress, at least, that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.